greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the origin of the public schools right after this. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets 60%. That's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25% and the government net 75%. Now that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more or less than 10% more net take-home pay than you did this year, and that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information. It answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we're paying so much and receiving so little. Let me teach you how to do just that in my tax and status school. That school now, by the way, is available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Now, to order that free general law CD package, just call direct, 417-273-4167. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org, click on to the email. Send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Remember, the Tax and Status School is also available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Why don't you call right now before you forget that number again, 417-273-4967. All right, last time I gave you an introduction to poison drops in the public schools. There's Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, I guess, is the total name of the book, written by Zach Montgomery. Now, Montgomery had been appointed as the Assistant United States Attorney General in 1886 under President Grover Cleveland. But the problem that he faced was his opposition to the public schools. And because of that opposition to the public schools, the Senate wouldn't confirm him. And so he said, well, let me write a book. So he sat down, he wrote this book called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, and points out that there are four major areas of social concern. That is crime, welfare, suicide, and insanity. And in all four of those social categories, crime goes up when you spend more money and educate more people in public school. We saw the same thing happen with the Amish in 1970, 100 years later, in Wisconsin. So it's been tested for 30 years, from 1850 to 1880, in the 6 New England public schools and the 6 Southern schools, 6 separate Southern states, from 1850 to 1880, to see what the correlation was. And we find that in every one of those categories, the crime goes up, welfare goes up, suicide goes up, mental illness goes up when you spend more money on or you send those children to public school. Never an exception to the rule. Hasn't been from that day to this. And we find that the more money we spend on public school, the poorer Johnny can read, the greater crime, the greater are the social problems that develop, such as rape, robbery, assault, burglary, arson, bombings, murder, suicide, absenteeism, vandalism, extortion, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, gang warfare, pregnancies, abortions, and venereal disease. That's what's going on in your public schools today, and in that order reported by the Department of Education. Now, 50 years ago, the biggest problems in school was talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, wearing improper clothing, or not putting paper in waste baskets. After 1962, when we took God and the Bible out of our public schools, it got worse. Montgomery is pointing out that even when you had God and the Bible in the public schools, as soon as you change the system from parental education to political education, you ran into problems. Education in America today is handled by the political process. It's the politicians that determine what your children should or should not know, what they should or should not learn, how the school system is going to be run, as opposed to parents, educators, or in the case of homeschoolers, should parents educate their children at home, or should parents determine what religious upbringing and education they should receive in parochial school? The state's taken that out of your hands and told you to put your children in public school. Now, you have three ways to educate your child: homeschool, public school, or parochial school. Choice is yours. You can make that choice. There's a pressure that's put on parents to educate their children in public school, both financial and political. And you could even translate that into legal. And the legal problem isn't there. The political problem is, what will your neighbors think? Now, last time we were taking a look at the states and the increase that we find in expenditures and the increase we find in crime, suicide, welfare, and insanity in the public schools. Taking a look at New York State in 1850. In 1850, the state of New York had a native-born population of about 2.5 million. In her schools, they had about 725,000 pupils at an annual cost of around $2.5 million. Now, it was about $3.50 per student per year. At that time, her native-born criminals numbered 650. That was about one out of every 3,700 native inhabitants. But with the laudable purpose of lessening the tendency of her people to commit crime, the state government went on, year by year, increasing the burdens of taxation for public school purposes until, in 1880, 30 years later, the receipts for education of a million children were about $11 million. That was about $11 for every pupil that entered her schools. A million students, $11 million, $11 per head. With a white population of about 4 million, she had 5,000 native white criminals in prison, being one in every 750 people instead of one in every 3,700 as in 1850. Notice that it moved from one out of 3,700 to one in 750. Now let's just take the 3,754 and divide that by 741. Now, that's a 5 times increase in crime in 30 years, and they moved the expenditures from $2.50 to $12, or $11 in round numbers, so from $2.55. So they multiplied this by about 5 times more money, and they got 5 times more criminal behavior. And that's the pattern that we saw in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And when they tested it in New York, it worked out the same. Let's take another state over here. The state of Ohio in 1850 had a native population of about 1.75 million and was spending or expending on 500,000 students about $1 million, or about $2 per pupil. At that time, she had 102 native-born criminals. In 1850, there were 102 criminals in Ohio. That was about one out of every 17,000 people. But in 1880, she was receiving from her people $11 million for public school education, 750,000 students, $15 per pupil, and out of a native white population of 2.7 million, they had 1,674 criminals. That's one to every 1,626 in place of one in every 17,000 in 1850. In other words, While Ohio was increasing her expenditures upward sevenfold in order to check crime, the criminals increased upwards of tenfold. And that comes from the census report of 1880. So while the state of Ohio increased public school education funding by 7 times, crime went up 10 times. Just like the New England states, just like New York. Let's take a look at Illinois. Illinois in 1850. In 1850, that state was expending on 130,000 students $400,000, or about $3 per head. Out of a population of 736,000, there was 164 criminals in Illinois in 1850. That was one out of every 4,488 inhabitants. But she went on increasing her godless education fund until in 1880 she was spending on 700,000 children $9.8 million, $14 per pupil, and out of a native population of 2.5 million, they had 2,223 native-born white criminals, or 1 to every 1,100. To put the case in words instead of figures, it may be stated this way. In order to prevent crime in Illinois, and thus to protect the property and lives and liberties and the reputations of her citizens, Illinois, in the space of 30 years, quadrupled the annual expenditures per capita for the anti-parental education of her students. And the result was more than quadrupled the ratio of her native-born white criminals to prey upon those very same people. 4-to-1 increase. Now, we cannot, in the short space of one article, review the history of education and crime in all of our states, but we must not close without a brief discussion of our own state, California. In 1860, California had in her public schools 25,000 students with an income for public school purposes of about $350,000, or $14 for each student. The record of crime among the native-born whites at that time surpassed everything in the United States except that of Massachusetts. She then had, out of a native white population of 233,000, some 336 native white convicts. That was one for every 700 population. But in 1880, California collected an income of $3.5 million for the use of 160,000 students. That was $22 a head for each pupil that ever darkened the door of a public schoolhouse at any time during the year. $33 for each of the 106,000 in average daily attendance. And she had a corresponding crop of adult native white criminals of 1,396, now it's about 1,400, out of a white population of 500,000, being one in every 393 of her native white population. And if to these we add her 142 native white youth serving time in reformatories, we have one native white criminal to every 357 white native inhabitants. Now that's 2-to-1 in 20 years. So they doubled the criminals in California, the criminal population per capita, in 20 years, 1860 to 1880. Now, think of that for a moment. Doubled in 20 years. You see the same trend in every one of these public school states, every state that adopted public school, and we get that same ratio. In 1850, in conclusion, we should let us take a bird's eye view of this question of anti-parental education and crime, as it affected the whole country at the two periods above named, to wit, in 1850 and in 1880. In 1850, our income in the whole United States for public and private schools was $16 million. The whole number of students in both classes of schools at that time was about 3.5 million. Consequently, our expenditures for education purposes were $4.40 per pupil. At that time, our native white population numbered 17 million. Our native white criminal population, 4,000. That's about 1 to every 4,000 of the native white population, leaving out the fractions. Now, in 1880, our public school income alone reached the enormous sum of $96 million. That's just a shade shy of $100 million. That was about $10 per pupil for each of the 10 million pupils, let's see if I'm right, yeah, 10 million, who at any time during the year entered a public schoolhouse, or counting the 6 million in average daily attendance, and we have $15 per pupil, and during that year, 1880, out of a native white population of 36 million, we had 29,377 native white criminals, making one criminal for every 1,254 inhabitants, instead of one out of every 4,000 as we had in 1850. So instead of one out of 4,000, that's now one out of 1,250. If to the above number we add the 9,000 native white juvenile convicts in our 71 reformatory institutions, we shall have 38,500, or one out of every 950 native white people. That's 4-to-1, a 4-to-1 increase in 30 years nationwide. Now, you saw in Ohio, it jumped 10-to-1. In California, it was 2-to-1. Nationwide, 4-to-1, using the public school system. Now, should any mistake in any of our figures be discovered, we shall be obliged to the person making such discovery to inform us of this fact, and we have no desire to perpetuate an injustice even against as great an enemy of our race as we believe our anti-parental public school system to be. So we here take occasion to caution the reader, as we have done before, against drawing from our figures or our arguments any inference that we look upon education as the cause of crime. On the contrary, we maintain that ignorance is the mother of vice, but it is against a fault system of education that we're leveling our batteries. A system that entrusts to politicians an authority over your child, which can only be properly wielded by you, the parent. In the face of these startling statistics, is it not high time for those who claim that the present public school system tends to diminish crime to point out at least one state or one fraction of any one state in the entire United States of America where this public school system has not produced exactly the opposite result? Now, our figures are official. They come from the Census Department, and if any friend of our present public school system will take them, read them, study them, and from them, or any other reliable authority, prove that the present public school system tends to prevent crime, he will perform a more stupendous miracle than if he should raise the dead to life. Now, we should take a look here in Chapter 5. The question of yet another startling test, a voice from the grave of the suicide. What effect has the public school system had on suicide? Now, you'll notice that in America, we have a problem with teen suicide. Do you remember these students out there in Colorado, Columbine? These two boys went in there and killed, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 students, and then turned around and killed themselves, committed suicide. How common is suicide among teenagers? It's about the fourth or fifth leading cause of death among teens, suicide. Why are young people killing themselves? You ever wonder about that? Has it always been that way? If it hasn't always been that way, when did it begin to increase? Is there any way that we could put a date on it? Any way that we could draw some correlations and say, well, gosh, maybe our lifestyle, maybe our diet, maybe our education, maybe, you know, let's see if we can identify what causes suicide, what has caused the increase in suicide? Well, the gratuitous and utterly unsupported assertion has sometimes been made by friends of state-controlled public education that the reason why statistics show the largest list of criminals in those localities where the most money has been lavished upon the public school system is because those are the only localities where the criminals are all or nearly all caught and convicted. While in those other places where there is little or no public school training, the criminals cannot be caught. I got to pause here for a moment. Does that mean that the criminals who were not educated in public school are smarter than the criminals educated in the public schools, and therefore homeschooled criminals are able to get away with their crimes and public school educated criminals get caught. That doesn't say very much for public school boys and girls, does it? Now we will scarcely, or now it will scarcely be denied that dead criminals can be caught, even in those states where they have no public schools. Then how stands the record with reference to this particular class of criminals? As we've already seen, it was in the early period of their first settlement in America that the colonists of Massachusetts, Maine, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Rhode Island tried the experiment of taking from the fathers and mothers the educational control of their own children and trusting it to the general public, while six other colonies, to wit Maryland, Virginia, Delaware, Georgia, North and South Carolina, left this educational control of children in the hands of their parents, their natural guardians, and with slight exceptions in a few of the last-named communities towards the close of the period, this experiment continued down to 1860. Now, the comparative number of suicides in these two localities, as shown by the United States Census report for that year, was as follows. In Maine, there was one suicide to every 19,000, New Hampshire, 1 out of 10,000, Vermont, 1 out of every 15,000, Massachusetts, 1 out of 11,000, Connecticut, 1 out of 16, and Rhode Island, 1 out of every 12,000. The other chart shows that in Maryland there was 1 out of every 49,000, Virginia 1 out of 53,000, Delaware 1 out of 56,000, Georgia 1 out of 48,000, North Carolina 1 out of 66,000, South Carolina 1 out of 87,000. In the aggregate, if you took the state education, the state-controlled education, there's about one suicide out of every 13,000. And in the parental education states, there's about one out of every 56,000. So let's just take 56,000 divided by 13. 56 divided by 13. What do we get? 4 to 1. Suicide rates in public education versus parental education is 4 to 1 higher. Why is that? How come? Why don't we see that suicides are 4 times higher in parental education states? I mean, after all, if the public school system is so damn good, then it ought to be producing a better result. So if there's a suicide out of every 56,000 in homeschool or parochial school, then public school, if it's better, ought to have a rate that would show that there's less suicide in public educated children, that there's less crime in public educated children, there's less welfare in public educated children, there's less insanity in public educated children. That's what we should see. Now, I'm not opposed to public education. I think that people should have a right to choose. I'm a libertarian in that regard, and I think if you want to educate your child in public school, you should have a right to do that. I don't think I should come to you and say, no, no, you cannot educate your child in public school. Let me ask all of you public school people out there, why is it then that you pick up this evangelistic zeal and require of the rest of us that we educate our children in the public school system? Why can't we have that same freedom of choice that we afford to you? Why can't we educate our children at home? Why can't we educate our children in parochial school? Why can't we educate our children without you watching over us? After all, we produce fewer criminals, fewer insane, fewer suicides, and fewer welfare recipients than you do. We pay the same taxes that you do. Why is it that these zealots of the public school system deny freedom of choice to the parents who want to educate their children at home and prosecute them and persecute them and hassle them over such a failed system as public education in these four areas? I mean, we're not talking about drugs here. We're just talking about four areas. We're not talking about rape and robbery and assault and burglary and arson, bombings, murder, suicide, and absenteeism, per se. We're just talking about four areas of social responsibility. That is crime, insanity, welfare, and suicide. Now, you could say that rape and robbery and assault and burglary are all crimes. Well, I guess talking, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, and wearing improper clothing and not putting your waste paper in a waste paper basket, those are crimes. Those are violations of the rules. But, you know, talking in class, chewing gum and making noise doesn't compare to rape, robbery, and assault, does it? Running in the halls, getting out of turn in line, and wearing improper clothing doesn't compare with burglary, arson, or bombings, does it? I just thought I'd point that out for all of you religious zealots out there that want to share the public schools with everybody else. From my point of view, you can take your public schools and shove it. Now, did I need to get any clearer than that? Now, the comparative number of suicides in these two localities, remember these two sets of states, New England and the southern states. The reports for the year, I gave you those reports, there's one in every 13,000, this is suicide now, up in those public school states, and one out of 56,000 in the southern states. An analysis of these figures will show that in every solitary instance where the political state had controlled the education and training of children, the ratio of suicides ranged from 250% to 800% higher. Higher than where the education and training had been left to parental control, while the aggregate ratio shows over four times as many suicides under state education as under parental education, this enormous excess in the number of suicides amongst people educated under state control over that found amongst those educated under parental control must have a cause, and a cause adequate to the effect. So now, what is the cause? In explanation of the facts shown by the foregoing statistics, we maintain that there are chiefly two causes, both of which are intimately connected, the one, in fact, springing from the other. The first cause, which we propose to consider, is the loss of parental authority and home influence over children through and by means of a state-controlled system of education. The second cause, and the one which, as just stated, is closely allied to the first, is a neglect of moral and religious education and training. Now, here's your two posits here. The first cause is a loss of parental authority. The second is the neglect of moral and religious education and training. Two causes. It requires very little argument to prove either to the readers of history or to the close observer of current events or to any affectionate son or daughter who has grown to manhood or womanhood under the guardianship of an intelligent, affectionate, and conscientious father and mother that parental influence is one of Almighty God's chief agencies for promoting the purity, the preservation, and the happiness of the human race. All of history, all of philosophy, and all of poetry point to the home as the birthplace and the nursery of virtue, morality, patriotism, and religion. Home is the ever-living fountain of present joy, sweet memories, and cherished hopes. Where is the little lad or lass whose heart does not gladden, whose eye does not brighten, and whose pace does not quicken, while returning from field or forest or school, when nearing the loved spot where he or she calls by the sacred name of home? What colors can paint or what words describe the sweet pleasures of a truly happy home and happy home life? Now, what artist has ever yet delineated the matchless charms of the true conjugal and maternal love that beams in the eye, dimples the cheek or quivers in the voice of the true wife and mother, radiating, illuminating, and cheering her home and sending sunshine and warmth and life and hope and happiness into the hearts and souls of husband and sons and daughters and friends? Or where on earth can there be found a truer picture of the primeval paradise than in an intelligent, virtuous, orderly, affectionate, united, and happy family of father, mother, and children? He who enjoys such a home, or the cheering hope of such a home, or even the bright and soothing memory of such a home, will find therein an ever-present talisman, an almost infallible shield against the horrible crime of self-destruction, commonly known as suicide. Who in his sane mind and sober senses can ever seriously plot against his own life, however burdensome that life may have become, when remembering that in doing so, he is plotting against the happiness of brothers and sisters to whom he is bound by the endearing ties of blood and 10,000 sweet memories, against an aged father and mother whom he loves and by whom he is beloved in an ardor that knows no cooling, against the devoted and faithful wife of his bosom, and against his own helpless, innocent, and confiding babies? These considerations are, however, in one sense only collateral barriers against the crime of self-murder, self-destruction, commonly called suicide, unless supported by higher and stronger motives, are liable to be battered down by the surging billows of human passion, or to be crushed by the almost unbearable weight of worldly woes. But a deeper and stronger barrier against this black and horrid crime is found in an educated conscience. In marshaling our proofs in support of this proposition, we shall assert 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. But hang on a minute, I got to give you a reminder. Well, I put a mark here in the margin. And let's take a look at why when we come back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book called Poison Drops in the Federal Senate by Zach Montgomery, published in 1886. Is the book still in publication? Well, I got it in a reprinted form by St. Thomas Press, Post Office Box 35096, that's 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235, St. Thomas Press. Now, they may still be there, I don't know. First printing was 1968, second printing in 1983. It was first copyrighted in 1886 by Z. Montgomery. You might try that, St. Thomas Press. It's a small paperback volume that I have, 138 pages, Poison Drops in the Federal Senate is the name of it. Dynamite little book if you want to look at the history of public education in the United States. Now remember, we covered a similar topic here in the deliberate dumbing down of America. What was that lady's name? Charlotte Isherby. Odd name, Charlotte Isherby. The deliberate dumbing down of America. All right, taking a look then at suicide. We looked at crime, now we're going to look at suicide. He says, first, that man is a rational creature, and being rational, whatever man does, while possessed of his reason, he does for a motive. The motive may be a good motive, or it may be a bad motive, but it is nevertheless a motive. Second, above all other considerations, personal to himself. Every man naturally hates misery and loves happiness. Hence, whatever he does or refuses to do while in the exercise of his reason, he does that or he refuses to do that for the purpose of avoiding misery or of finding happiness. Third, men differ widely as to their choice of roads in the pursuit of happiness as well as in their efforts to avoid misery. And fourth, there are chiefly three roads by which men travel in their pursuit of happiness or in their flight from misery. Namely, first of all, the road which leads to gratification of the animal appetites and which avoids whatever tends to their restraint. Second, the road which leads to human applause and worldly honors while keeping at a distance from whatever wounds pride or vanity. Three, the road which leads to truth and justice, to the triumph of God Almighty's law, to honors imperishable, and to happiness unmixed with pain, and as enduring as eternity itself. Now, unlike the other roads, this turns neither to the right nor to the left, neither to shun that which pains the body or mortifies vanity or pride. Now its course is ever upward and onward. The truly faithful traveler upon this road, instead of repining at the endurance of bodily pain, the loss of fortune, the betrayal of friends, or the malice of enemies, seizes upon those passing woes as so many precious coins with which to purchase imperishable joys. Now, it requires but a moment's reflection to enable us to see that a man's choice as between these three roads must, in the nature of things, depend very much on his early training and education. Now, what is this cause to suicide that we're discussing? It requires a moment's reflection for us to see that a man's choice is between these three roads. Now, man has three classes of faculties. Three classes of faculties. Three roads to travel down, three faculties. Namely, the faculty of the body, the faculty of the mind, and the faculty of the conscience. And undoubtedly, all these three classes of faculties were designed by the Creator to be exercised and to be exercised in harmony. But in order to be exercised in harmony, it is necessary, in the nature of things, either that the demands of these three faculties be always in harmony, or else in cases of conflict, one class of desires must yield obedience to another class. But it is as easy to see that these three classes of desires are not always in harmony, because it's often, and it often happens, that one class of desires, as for example in the case of an inordinate desire for strong drink or impure pleasures, are directly at war both with the desires of the mind and the conscience, and it can scarcely require argument to prove that in such cases of conflict, the desires of the body ought to yield obedience to the opposing desires of mind and conscience. But then, again, the mind may, and often does, in defiance of conscience, at the peril of bodily health and life, and even at the hazard of disaster to itself, desire to circumvent, overreach, defraud, and ruin others, and would, in its vaulting ambition go so far as to usurp the throne of God Almighty Himself. Hence, in all cases of conflict between the unjust desires of mind and the dictates of conscience, and the conscience should rule supreme. And unless conscience do rule supreme, there is no adequate barrier to check the wrongs which the body and mind may perpetrate against themselves, against each other, against conscience, or against God, or against society and the members thereof. Hence, the true welfare, the safety, the happiness of every man's body, mind, and conscience, as well as the safety of society, demand that every man's conscience should reign supreme over both his bodily appetites and his mental desires, his aims, and his ambitions. But all these three classes of man's faculties need education, they need training, they need exercise. The physical man needs education. The physical man needs training. The physical man needs exercise, but only to give him bodily strength and skill, or not only to give him bodily strength and skill, but to teach and accustom him to subject his animal appetites to the dictates of his mind and his conscience. The mind needs to be taught and trained and exercised not only to strengthen and store it with knowledge necessary for the proper direction and government of the body and the enlightenment of itself and the conscience by the lamp of reason, but to accustom it to habits of prompt and willing obedience to the conscience. And the conscience needs to be educated, trained, and exercised in order that it may learn and accustom itself to walk always in the path whether duty calls and to which right reason points, and never to allow either itself or its mind or its body to stray from that path. But while it is true that the entire man, including his body, his mind, his conscience, requires education, training, and exercise, it is no less true that the conscience and governing part of man, most of all, requires this education, this training, this exercise. So if an individual, in the private walks of his life, makes a mistake for the want of proper education or training, the evil consequences of such a mistake are usually unfelt by the general public. But if the governor of a state or the president of the United States, for a similar reason, makes such a mistake in his official capacity, then the whole country must suffer the consequences of that mistake. So likewise, if for the want of proper bodily training, a boy stubs his toe or cuts his finger, while his body must endure a temporary pain, yet his mind is not impaired, nor his conscience tarnished. So if for want of mental education the boy should insist that the world is flat instead of round, or should prove himself so deficient in a knowledge of figures as to lose his situation, he might still escape the pangs of a guilty conscience and preserve a spotless reputation for integrity. But if for the want of a conscience, educated, trained, exercised, and strengthened in habits of honesty, he should pocket his employer's money in obedience to the demands of his animal appetite or to satisfy the claims of vanity, the whole man would suffer. For example, the conscience would suffer not only from remorse, but it would suffer from being blunted and obscured and rendered less fit to perform its functions. The mind would suffer from anxiety and the fear of discovery or from the mortification of detection, and the body would suffer from the labor required to cover the tracks of guilt or from being forced to endure the punishment which either the natural or the human law or both would visit upon him. Can it then be denied that the education, training, and constant exercise of the conscience is of the very first? It is the very most important in giving direction and formation to human character. Of course, we are now addressing ourselves to those who recognize the existence of the human conscience as the great director and regulator of human motives and human actions. Ought then the conscience of children to be developed, instructed, and exercised as a part of their education? And ought this instruction and education to go hand in hand with the education and training of the mind and body during the hours of school? It is maintained by multitudes of parents and many clergymen, while admitting that it is necessary that the consciences of children should be educated, that this education ought to be confined to the home circle and the church, and that the daily school should be exclusively reserved for the education of the mind and of the body. But have we not seen that the conscience must be the governor and supreme ruler of the entire man? And that the conscience must be taught the habit of governing, and that both the mind and the body must be taught habits of prompt and willing obedience. But if throughout the livelong day the conscience is to remain practically dormant while the mind and body are both in the process of active development, what will be the necessary result? Is it not a universally admitted fact that every human organ, whether it be an organ of the body, the mind, or the conscience, is strengthened by exercise and weakened by disuse? Then how is it possible that the conscience can maintain its supremacy over the mind and body if it is to be left sleeping or chained down in mute and motionless bondage, while the body and mind are daily growing in strength, activity, and habits of insubordination? If from the cradle to the grave there is any one period of life more than any other when the conscience not only needs to be trained but to be called into active service, it's during the time spent at school. It is then that pride and vanity and anger and lust and all of the other passions that war against conscience are in their most active state of development. And if instead of training these growing passions in habits of subjection to conscience, and instead of training the conscience to the habit of wielding its authority over these passions, the passions, on the contrary, be trained to lord it over the conscience, what must be the natural result? Now, when a child has reached manhood with passions fully developed and trained to command, and a conscience has been dwarfed and enfeebled by disuse, and trained to habits of base and cowardly servitude, what power, short of a miracle, can sufficiently restore the lost energy of such a conscience, or give it the mastery over the entire man? But when the conscience has lost her scepter and become the slave of the mere animal or the intellectual man, then such a man lives only for the present life and looks not beyond the portals of the grave, neither or either in his search for happiness or in his flight from pain. Such a man seeks happiness chiefly either in the gratification of his animal appetites or in the acquisition of wealth or in the paths of worldly ambition, marching to the music of human applause and grasping at the bubble of fame. So long as an average success continues to crown the efforts of one of these seekers after mere worldly happiness, and the chances are that he will consent to live, but let disaster overtake him, and what then? If a man of wealth let fires or floods or a touch of hard times sweep away his accumulated millions, if an overambitious man let the last lingering hope of political preferment be blasted, or if he be a man enchained in the bondage of his unholy lusts, let even the crime-steeped partner of his debaucheries frown cruelly upon him, and what assurance have we that he will not cut short the miserable existence that has ceased to yield pleasure and promises nothing but disappointment and further pain? Now, the man who suffers from a raging toothache is not censured for swallowing a small dose of laudanum in the hope of putting himself to sleep until the period of pain shall have passed. And if death were an eternal sleep, and life promised nothing but pain, who would be censured if, to escape a life of suffering or shame, he should so enlarge his dose of laudanum as to render his sleep perpetual? Here then, in our humble opinion, is the true source of that alarming growth of suicides so prevalent now in the United States. It is found in an educational system which has broken down parental authority, sundered the sacred bonds of affection that bound together brothers and sisters, parents and children, and which has weakened and almost obliterated the human conscience. It requires but a moment's reflection to show that the same causes which lead to the crime of suicide lead to every other crime known to the laws of God or man. Both reason and daily experience prove that the man or woman who has no sweet and endearing memories of childhood's home, who cherishes no love for father or mother, or brother or sister, and worse still, the man or woman who believes in no God, no devil, no heaven, no hell, can never be trusted. Such a man may reach the very pinnacle of wealth and fame and political power. He may be flattered and praised and applauded by the press and the people as the very pink of patriotism and honesty. But let the day of trial come. Let the voice of duty call. While his ruling passion for guilty pleasure, forbidden wealth, or crime-bought fame beckons to the left, and duty may call and call and call, but alas, it will call in vain. Now that was Zach Montgomery. Mr. Montgomery, I think, put his finger on the pulse of conscience, the pulse of the problem of public school. It educates the mind. It does not educate the character. It does not turn out character. It turns out knowledge. Useless, mindless knowledge. Kind of reminds me of the guy that spouts off about the baseball statistics. They can sit there and they can talk about this or that famous baseball player and how many home runs he hit or how many bases he stole. Mindless, useless knowledge. Colleges turn out students who can find pools of oil. We call them geologists. Or doctors who can operate in the ER, but who cannot control their own animal lusts. 50% of the medical doctors in America are on illegal drugs. 50%. That means that half the doctors in America are drug addicts, unable to control their animal lusts and passions. These are doctors, brilliant men, intelligent, smart, but without character and without the ability to choose right from wrong. And by the way, they die on average at age 58. Not necessarily from suicide, but suicide in America, in all of the professions, is high. And it gets higher every year. Suicide in America, as we progress along down the public education path, down the program that we have adopted from these New England schools, the public education system, which comes, by the way, from ancient pagan religious philosophies, from the ancient pagan Romans, the ancient pagan Babylonians, Assyrians, Athenians, Spartans, Egyptians, and on it goes. That's where it came from. It didn't come from God. It didn't come from the Bible. God told us in the Bible, through four statutes, here's how to educate children. Follow this educational program and you'll have good success. And if you don't, you won't. You'll have bad success. And we haven't followed those educational principles. And indeed, we have poor success. Now, we've looked at two. So we look at crime number one, and we find that crime, is four times higher nationwide from 1850 to 1880. As we spend more and more money on public schools, crime goes up. We find that from 1850 to 1880, crime and suicide go up at the same rates, four times higher in those in those states that practice the public education system over the parental education system. And that's not to say that the parental education system is perfect. Not everybody who practices the parental education system practices the laws of God or teaches his children the educational principles or follows the educational standards and statutes in the scripture. But it's a hell of a lot better than what's in second place, and public school is in second place, not first. It's not in first place in any of these categories. Next time we'll take a look at this thing of pauperism and insanity. I pointed out to you that in the Jonas Yoder case, which was a case that was tested over the Amish. You could take any group. Any group that practices these principles of religion, a fear of God, a belief in and a practice of right and wrong, of governing yourself through your conscience, whether they be Mormons or they be Amish or they be Catholics or Protestants or Jews. You take those religious principles and you practice them in a home environment, and the results are always better, in spite of the religion, always better than what you get out of public school. And that's why the Muslims hate us. They despise our filth and our perversion. And I've got to say, I don't blame them. I can hardly blame them. We want to export our filth and perversion over to the Middle East, and we want to export our movies and our concepts of politics and right and wrong and good and bad and so on. Our Western democracy, we call it. And we want to export this to the Middle East and the Muslims with their religious ideologies. They have conscience. They have beliefs. They actually believe in God. They believe in heaven and hell. They believe in something, not nothing. They may be ignorant camel jockeys wearing diapers on their heads, but they are moral people. They're not prostituting their sons and daughters and practicing sodomy and lesbianism. And they eschew that kind of filth and perversion that we're trying to enforce upon them. And in fact, Zach Montgomery pointed this out more than 100 years ago. He wrote this book in 1886, and he said, Do you see what we're doing to our own sons and daughters here in America? Are you really sure that this is what we want to do? He raised the question back in the 1880s, and he said, hey, I think we ought to think about this before we follow this road to perdition and oblivion. We didn't. We went ahead and we said, well, this is what we want to do in America. We followed this public education system, and we're following it today and exacerbating the problems. We want to spend more money on public education. It's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Since when does the practice of communism produce the kind of fruits that you want to eat? Communism is the system where we stand in line and share the shortage and have every wicked evil penalty result, every evil consequence that's imaginable to man. Why in the world would anybody in his right mind want to buy into such an insane program? The 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, free education for all children in public school. As I said before, you can take my share. Well, we're just about out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll be back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, reviewing the origin of the public schools. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Thanks for listening, and good night, friends.